Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, monastic reformer Pope Benedict talks about the life and teaching of the 8th century monk St. Theodore the Studite during his Wednesday general audience. Vatican commercials. We look at why Vatican Radio, for the first time in its long history, has decided to air advertising. Carnage of war. Listen to the dramatic testimony from a Catholic humanitarian relief worker from Sri Lanka, who witnessed at first hand the appalling suffering of civilians caught up in the firing line during the final stages of the war. And religious cleansing. We find out why tens of thousands of Christians in four of Nigeria's northern states have seen their homes destroyed and are now living in a state of fear. The life and teaching of the 8th century monk St. Theodore the Studite was the focus of Pope Benedict's catechesis during his Wednesday general audience. Lydia O'Kane tells us more.
The human aspect of work and the richness received from it has to be destined for the well-being of the community, while the fruits of work have to benefit everyone, including the poor. That was the recommendation of Pope Benedict as he reflected on one of the early Christian writers of the Church, St. Theodore the Studite, at his weekly general audience in St. Peter's Square on Wednesday.
Born in 759, to a noble and pious family, Theodore entered the monastery at the age of 22. He vigorously opposed the iconoclastic movement, since he argued abolishing images of Christ entails a rejection of his work of redemption. Theodore also initiated a thorough reform of the disciplinary, administrative, and spiritual aspects of monastic life. A particularly important virtue, according to Theodore, is philergia, the love of work, since diligence in material tasks indicates fervor in one's spiritual duties. He even described work as a type of liturgy, asserting that the riches mined from it must be used to help the poor. The Studite's rule holds particular relevance for us today because it highlights the unity of faith and the need to resist the danger of spiritual individualism. Maybe he, Theodore, summons to nurture the unity of the body of Christ through well-ordered lives and by cultivating harmonious relationships with another in the Holy Spirit.
The Pope also told the estimated 15,000 people gathered that only sobriety in life allows us to surpass the great problem of poverty in the world and helps us to build a united society. While giving his greeting in Italian, the Holy Father welcomed members of the St. Matthew Foundation, set up in memory of Vietnamese Cardinal Huynh Van Thuan. He thanked them for all their efforts to spread the social doctrine of the Church and, above all, to show the Church's closeness to all those who are poor, both financially and spiritually. At the end of his audience, Pope Benedict greeted all the English-speaking pilgrims present, including a famous political face, Britain's first woman Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, who he spoke to for a number of minutes. The Holy Father then departed the warmth of the Roman sunshine for the shade inside the Vatican. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
The familiar chimes of Christus Vincit, or Christ Conquers, which is the signature tune for Vatican Radio played between its programmes. One of the world's oldest broadcasters, Vatican Radio has just announced that it is to air advertising for the first time in its history. On July the 6th, the radio will broadcast its first commercial advert on behalf of the Italian electricity multinational Enel. Vatican Radio was set up with the help of the Italian inventor Guglielmo Marconi in 1931 and was inaugurated with a message by Pope Pius XI. It now broadcasts around the clock and around the world in over 40 different languages. So why has the Radio of the Pope decided to run commercials on its airwaves? A question my colleague Philippa Hitchin put to Archbishop Renato Boccardo, General Secretary of the Governing Body of the Vatican City State.
Well, we need to find money to help the daily life of Vatican Radio. And we thought that it was a good possibility to ask for some help around, especially in some very official or very formal institution like Enel. But what is important is the way to help the Vatican Radio to go around, to be present around the world, to spread the voice of the Holy Father.
There will be those who are very concerned. Enel is a well-known national, international institution. There will be those who are concerned. How is this process of deciding who can advertise and who can't? How will that be done?
I think that there is a team of people working on it, and they have to find those who are willing to help, and they have to submit it to the final approval to the Vatican Radio. So it will be the direction of Vatican Radio who has to say the final word about the acceptance or not of different proposals.
This will be advertising in many different languages, not just Italian.
We hope so. For the moment, we start with Italian, but we hope to be able to do it in different languages.
I know you may not be able to give me definite figures, but how much money are we talking about? How much are you hoping to make from this initial project? And how exactly will it be structured, this first phase?
You know, it's very difficult now to say, because we start and we will check if it works. For the moment, as they said, there are about, I think, 20 or 30,000 euros, but we have to see for the future. It's not possible for now because it's the first initiative, so we have to check if it works or not.
Archbishop Renato Boccardo speaking to Philippa Hitchin. In Sri Lanka, the guns may be silenced after decades of civil war, but how easy will it be for the island to achieve national reconciliation and address the legitimate aspirations of the minority Tamils? The final stages of the war, leading up to last week's defeat of the Tamil Tiger rebels, saw around 250,000 civilians trapped in the ever-shrinking conflict zone. Nobody yet knows for sure how many civilians died during the final offensive, but the scale of the humanitarian suffering is on a huge scale. The rebels were accused of using the local population as a human shield, while the government was accused of indiscriminate shelling. An estimated 275,000 people have been left displaced by the conflict, and the priority now is ensuring they can be resettled as soon as possible. Many of them emaciated and traumatized, these displaced people poured out of the combat zone in the final stages of the war and have been housed in severely overcrowded closed camps run by the government. The UN and relief organizations have been calling on the government to allow unimpeded access to these camps, saying the restrictions are worsening the humanitarian situation for these people who have already suffered so much. So, just how bad was the suffering of civilians caught up in the line of fire as the two sides battled it out during the war's final weeks? One person who knows from first-hand experience is Vini, a Tamil Catholic humanitarian worker who was based in the so-called safe zone of Vani in northern Sri Lanka. I began by asking him to describe the mood of the Tamil population now that the war is over.
Primarily, it would be sorrow, pain, agony, and also fear.
Are they hopeful that the government will honour its promises to reach out to the Tamil community, to grant them some degree of autonomy, to answer their grievances?
Given the experiences of the past, it will be very difficult for the Tamil community to believe that the government will be very fair to them. Because during the war, the government never kept up to its promises. For example, the no-fire zone was never a no-fire zone. Things like that, and thousands of people were killed. And particularly during the last phase itself, more than 25 to 30,000 people were killed and wounded. And we don't know the fate of the people. How many were killed and how many were wounded, exactly nobody knows.
There's about 300,000 Tamils in these government-run camps, very overcrowded, and the government has not yet
honoured the promises to allow unimpeded access to these camps by aid organisations. Do you have any inkling yourself of what conditions are like in these camps? You know, we heard the UN Secretary General describe them as very, very bad, but can you tell us in more detail?
Certain things were being distributed to the people, say like food was allowed at a time, and educational aid was allowed for the children. And in general, the security is highly questionable, and the health condition, medical facilities that are provided, and the separation of the families in various camps.
But do they have enough food and water, the basics?
No, I don't think so. It's not enough. The government itself cannot manage that. So the necessity of the involvement of the international organizations is a must, but the government has not given access to them so far, even though the pleas have been many.
Do you think that under international pressure the government will give way, or do you think it'll wait until it's carried out this screening of the inmates?
I think that will be closer to the truth.
You yourself were trapped in the so-called safe zone for a number of years, and you were actually holed up in a bunker to escape the shelling for a month or so. Can you tell us something about conditions then?
It is a normal thing that every family and every house had a bunker. So it was not only me, it was a common feature for all the people that they had to hide themselves in bunker. And as the intensity of the operations went on, became more and more aggressive, so the stay in the bunkers also were extended. Initially we could cook and eat and there was space. But as the war came closer and closer to our territories, it was becoming impossible even to have a proper bath or even to cook and eat food. Everything had to be according to the attacks. When the shelling was there, you rush to the bunker to protect yourself. And once the shelling is over and there is a pause, you come out and do your things. And again, once the shelling starts, you go back to the bunker. It was like a back and forth.
So very intensive shelling, as you say, where you couldn't really lead an uninterrupted normal life.
Yeah.
The accounts, of course, of these people who fled during the final stages of the war, it talked about emaciated people. Did you see yourself people who were clearly emaciated and short of food?
Of course. For the first time, starvation deaths occurred when I was there. That 13 people died of starvation for the first time in the history of Vanni. Because no agricultural lands, no vegetation, no paddy, nothing. Only we were the only nutritious food was fish that was available from the sea. Even rice was dwindling, so totally we were dependent on the dry rations issued by the government. And here comes the important factor. The government was, from the beginning, saying that there were 70,000 people in the safe zone. But in fact, 300,000 people had been there, and we were telling that. But now it is proved. So now this, again, the question is, was the government sincere towards the people? Because the food and medicine were used as weapons of war to frustrate the people, perhaps to wean them away from the tigers.
Were people getting fed up with the tigers, fed up with the war, and were they turning against the tigers?
Oh, definitely, because the tigers were becoming more aggressive towards the end, especially from roughly March to May, because they were demanding all the able-bodied persons to join the ranks of the fighting cadres. And that broke down the relationship with the population. And there were a lot of clashes between the people and the tigers. And at times the tigers have beaten the people, killed people, and it was atrocious. So the people were really caught in between the devil and the deep blue sea.
The UN says that there's strong possibilities that both sides were guilty of war crimes. I mean, the tigers that were using the civilians as cannon fodder or human shields, and the government forces that were doing indiscriminate shelling in heavily populated areas. Do you think there are grounds for this?
Definitely, because first of all, about the tigers, I have told you that these tigers were determined not to allow the people to go out. Whether they were used, okay, on the one hand, it can be looked upon as using them as human shields. From another angle, because they didn't want to lose their territory, the de facto territory, however smaller it was, to hold on to that. So these two could be combined in understanding. But definitely the people were not freely allowed to go out, even if they wanted. That is true. And on the side of the government, the weapons that were used, and that is the artillery, the multi-barrel rocket launchers, the supersonic fighter jets, and cluster bombs, very indiscriminately used cluster bombs, and also chemical weapons, all these banned items. And people were getting killed like worms in the no-fire zone.
How traumatized did you find the people were? Can you give us anecdotes that maybe sort of illustrate, you know, how traumatized people were?
For example, at a time, a man's mother was wounded. And she could have been saved if she were taken to the hospital, but the situation was intense shelling. And the man had no other option but to bury her almost 25% alive still. So this is a typical one example I can give of the. And many people were just buried wherever they were killed. They were never taken to the hospital. And taking the people to the hospital itself is a big process because the roads are congested, heavy traffic, because 300,000 people occupying about 25-30 square kilometers area, and in the midst of shelling and aerial bombing. So it has been, many people would have been saved because many of them lost a lot of blood on the way bleeding. So by the time they reached the hospital, many of them died. Many of them died because lack of medication. So it was very intense and very painful. And traumatization at all levels, because people didn't have enough strength to face it, physical strength, because lack of food, lack of medical facilities, and lack of shelter facilities, and constant threat from the air, because you never know what will happen, terrible anxiety of the people. So the whole life lent itself for traumatization and intense traumatization.
And what about the role of the local Catholic Church in these Tamil areas? What sort of role was it playing?
I think the priests who were living there, as far as I know, they struggled with the people and struggled for their dignity, and they struggled with the tigers to establish justice towards the people and not to be so harsh and turn their venom against the people, and they fought against that. That much I can tell you with certainty.
What do you think are the lessons to be learned from this war?
Lessons to be learned: war is always evil, and I hate war, not only in Sri Lanka, for that in any part of the world, because war is atrocious. It just kills and destroys and butchers people. And the flesh and blood that we have witnessed, I wouldn't like that to happen anywhere else. That is my first lesson. Second lesson is, wars are not created by the people themselves. These are all instigated. And at the third thing is, at the root of this instigation, there is some injustice, institutionalized injustice, which were fought with non-violent means and which were suppressed with violent means. And eventually it turned out to be armed struggle. And I think if the injustices are rectified at the earlier stages, I think we can prevent this human tragedy and catastrophes.
And how easy will it be to win the peace?
It will be very difficult, very difficult.
Why is that?
Given the nature of the divide and the conception that the Sri Lankan country, Sri Lanka, belongs only to the Sinhalese and the Buddhists, and all the other minorities have to find their places within the structure. And I think this is basically against the dignity, equality and humanity of all the people. So the country of Sri Lanka to come up and prosper, I think this fundamental dignity and equality of all the people has to be assured. Until then, I think it will be very difficult. This change has to happen if we want to grow together and live peacefully and prosper.
You say about recognizing the dignity of all Sri Lankans or all the people in Sri Lanka, but what specific acts could the government take to try to reach out to the Tamil community and try to overcome this mistrust and achieve reconciliation, however difficult that may be?
The basics will be, somehow the struggles boil down to, say, opportunities, equal opportunities. With the independence, somehow the much-needed rectification of the injustices the Sinhalese faced during the period of colonization, they were rectified to a greater extent. But the proportion was not sufficient enough when it comes to the minorities. So the need is, first of all, to assure the Sri Lankans, without any beyond their divide, that all will have the equal opportunity to come up in life. And immediately this refers to some sort of autonomy, not only in the economic sector, but also in the decision-making sector.
Do people there fear that the remnants of the Tamil Tigers will continue to carry out sporadic guerrilla attacks in the future?
Immediately, we don't think so.
So how do you see the future playing out at this stage?
Future playing out, I think it depends much on the political will of the government as well as the political will of the international community, which could help the government to see reality and to go forward rather than redress.
And if you could just maybe pinpoint for me some of the worst experiences either you or these people have undergone in the war?
The worst experience will be the total destruction, utter destruction of a living area. The one is totally destroyed. East is totally destroyed. The war has destroyed wherever the war has taken place. So this is the greatest tragedy, losing one's land, one's livelihood, houses, properties, hard-earned livings. everything is lost. Besides that, lives. And worst is, for the first time we experienced deaths of fetuses. And that was terrible.
What, you mean because they were aborting?
No. Abortions were taking place because of the shocks.
Oh, I see. Miscarriages.
Miscarriages, that was one. But the other one is the baby within the womb of the mother being injured with shrapnels. For the first time we saw that, and it was terrible. So many thousands of children have lost their limbs and they are amputated. And it is, I think, even to our enemy, that should not happen.
I was speaking to Vinny, a Tamil Catholic humanitarian worker, about his recent experiences in the combat zone of Sri Lanka. Many Christians living in Nigeria's northern states fear they're becoming the victims of a systematic and violent campaign by radical Islamists seeking to drive them out. Human rights activists say dozens of Christians in the states of Kano, Bauchi, Plateau and Niger have been killed or are missing, while an estimated 50,000 have been left homeless following a series of brutal attacks in recent months. More than a dozen churches are reported to have been burnt by the militants, and many homes and businesses belonging to Christians have been destroyed. Baroness Caroline Cox is an independent member of Britain's House of Lords and the founder of a humanitarian human rights organisation called Humanitarian Aid Relief Trust. She's recently returned from a visit to northern Nigeria, where she says there is strong evidence that these Islamist militants are striving to destabilise the country through these targeted attacks on the Christian community.
The concern over the recent violence in Plateau, Bauchi, Niger and Kano states is based on the evidence, much of which we witnessed for ourselves in a visit over Holy Week and Easter, of systematic attacks on Christian communities in those areas, and they clearly are targeted at Christians. It is Christians who are killed. Many, many churches have been destroyed systematically, and in the attacks, the main perpetrators who initiate the violence clearly are Islamists, in the sense that they are radical extremist Muslims who will come shouting the jihad slogans of Allah Akbar, and they leave those slogans written on the properties they destroy. And they're well-organized attacks, and they clearly also have a political agenda which is designed to terrorize the Christians and maybe to affect the political composition of some of the key voting areas, like the area in Jos in Plateau State, where they're very keen to drive out the Christians and to maintain their own constituency.
But do these militants represent just a very small minority among the Muslim population? I mean, how are relations in general between Christians and Muslims in these states?
Historically, the relations between the Christians and Muslims in these states in Nigeria have, on the whole, been good, but that has been interrupted by episodic bouts of violence, predominantly, again, against the Christians. I'm not being partial. All the evidence does show that the massive asymmetry in the destruction of buildings, whether it's places of worship or homes or businesses, it is the Christian communities that suffer by far the greatest destruction and also violence perpetrated against individuals. For example, last year, in 2008, we were up in Bauchi State, and we visited one area where eight churches had been destroyed, including right across the denominations, Catholic, Anglican, and more evangelical churches. And in Kano City itself, a very large Catholic church had been bulldozed to the ground. And again, just recently in Bauchi State, 40 churches have been destroyed. So it is, I'm afraid, religiously motivated violence, not by the vast majority of the Muslim community, but by small groups of extremists who are carrying out this violence.
And what's the mood like among the Christians that you've visited and maybe gotten a chance to talk to who've been targeted in these or other attacks in the past?
One of the things which humbles us when we visit the Christian communities here is that they clearly have suffered. I mean, just recently, over the period leading up into Easter time and in February of this year, 2009, I mean, Christians have been burnt alive. Christians have seen their families slaughtered, throats cut, people thrown into burning houses, and therefore there is an obviously an atmosphere of real fear and anxiety. but also I'm so amazed because there's always enormous faith and enormous joy when they worship. And when we spent Good Friday in Bauchi State, although the people had recently suffered killings and a lot of their churches and homes destroyed, and many were living in very poor conditions in exile in their own city, when they worship, there is great joy. So faith is resilient.
And do any of them consider leaving, or do they mostly want to stay?
What's one of the interesting developments in the recent attacks has been an understanding by the Christian communities, again, across all denominations, that perhaps one of the objectives of the destruction of the Christian homes and churches is to drive them out of the areas where they've been living. And so on this recent visit, they have got together. And, for example, when we were in Plateau State, in one of the areas in Jos that had been really wiped out, we met the Christian communities there, and they were writing very firmly on their remains of their homes and their destroyed churches, "This church is not for sale, this house is not for sale," because they had been realizing that perhaps one of the objectives behind the attacks in the communities was to approach them when they were still feeling very vulnerable, shocked, had lost everything. This had happened, and then the Muslim communities offered to buy up their destroyed homes and the area, and then to move in and change the constituency of that location. So it's very poignant. You walk through those areas now, you see the totally destroyed homes, just shells left, but written everywhere, "This house is not for sale." So they determined to hang in there, and they were busy trying to at least restore enough to move back into the rainy season. And one of the Catholic church leaders was providing a wonderful service to the community, providing roofing for people to come back at least to get some shelter in their devastated homes during the rainy season.
Apart from these attacks, your report says that Christians in northern states such as Bauchi and Kano have suffered severe and systematic discrimination in many aspects of their daily lives. Can you give us some concrete examples of this?
When we visit the Christians in the areas, largely the states which are already under Sharia law, we find a lot of evidence on them, a lot of concern of such systematic discrimination in many ways that they call it almost religious cleansing. For example, systematic discrimination in employment. So it's very hard for Christians to get jobs and therefore to make a living and to sustain a living. So a steady escalation, if you like, of discrimination in ways which is making life very, very difficult. Similarly with access to healthcare and to education, so difficult that many Christians feel they're almost being squeezed out, and that may be part of a deliberate policy of religious cleansing of Christians from those areas. Not as yet universally harsh, and may vary from Sharia state to Sharia state, but certainly for Christians in many of those areas, life is becoming increasingly difficult and almost intolerable.
And are there fears that these sporadic acts of violence could degenerate into a wider civil conflict?
One of the fears from our recent visits to Nigeria in the north has been a widespread concern that the episodic violence is part of a longer-term strategy to destabilize the north. And one of our fears is that if there's such violence, and it is very harsh violence and is creating an atmosphere of insecurity and indeed terror, may result in the destabilization of Nigeria, because much of Nigeria at the moment is relatively peaceful and prosperous, but there's increasing tensions in the north which could have a trigger effect throughout the rest of Nigeria, which is a very serious situation.
I was speaking there to Baroness Cox about her recent visit to northern Nigeria. Well, that's all for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.